Hey, Paul, it's me, Wolfie. What kind of agent are you? You told me the Letterman gig was a lock for me. Okay, so that means I get the Colbert slot? Chris Hardwick? Shouldn't he come on after my show and discuss what happened on it? Okay, who gets his midnight slot? Amy Schumer. All right, well, that opens up the Inside Amy Schumer half hour. Craig Ferguson is taking over Inside Amy? Isn't that a step backward? Okay, well, who gets his show? Harriet Jones? Come on, I know Harriet Jones. She's nice, but she's mainly Scottish. What do they do in that time slot? Macbeth skits every night? Look, I see how this works. One window closes, but it makes another one open, and then that window closes, and then another one opens, and so on, right? No, I don't want a window. God, you are the worst agent. No, Paul, I'm asking you this. After all these other people are done leapfrogging one step forward, what finally opens up for me? North Dakota Community Access? That can be a springboard. Do I have Polka Spotlight as a lead-in? Huh. Preventing livestock theft is even better. Half the audience uses it as a dating site, if you know what I mean. Do they agree to 2 bottles of Fiji water in the dressing room every night? Galvanized metal pail with a ladle is very hipster, very Etsy. Fiji is so last year anyway. Okay, Paul, make the deal. The rest of you get ready for the nose. We've got plenty to talk about. And now he accidentally created Heartbleed while trying to tweet a picture of his cat. Colin McEnroe.
That's not exactly true, but I do know that they will eventually blame Heartbleed on some old person like me using the internet wrong. You know, that's what's going to happen. It's going to be somebody's mother trying to put something up on Facebook, and it caused this horrible thing which wrecked everybody's internets. All right, so, but that's not what we're talking about today. Here on The Nose, we have so many other things on our minds, starting with, in fact, the ascension of Stephen Colbert, if that's the right word. I think it is the right word. The ascension of Stephen Colbert to the late night show vacated by David Letterman. That'll all happen probably right at the beginning of 2015. But has some kind of interesting implications, which I hope we can talk about in the second segment. We will talk once again, because he just never quite leaves us alone, about the indictment of former governor and more recently a talk show host, John Rowland. Also towards the end, we'll talk about the latest update of the papyrus that seems to suggest that at least in one gospel, I want to say this as accurately as possible, that at least one gospel, Jesus is seen to speak of a wife. And so we have with us, one reason we have to talk about this is we have with us today Susan Campbell, whose books include Dating Jesus. So, like, how could we not talk about whether Jesus had a wife or not? Although, more recently, her biography of Isabella Hooker is what everybody's talking about right now. And the name of the biography is?
Tempest Tossed, The Spirit of Isabella Beecher Hooker.
All right. And from you'll hear more about that later as we ruthlessly plug her appearance next week. James Hanley's here from Trinity Cine Studio, just passing around flyers that look like it's going to be a great schedule coming up ahead. And from Trinity College, Professor Luis Figueroa is with us. We are going to start. And by the way, if you have things that you want to say, we are going to start. Please call us 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet at us. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. With this move by Colbert, which, you know, in some ways this is sort of the entertainment business. Who cares about it? Except that I would argue that Colbert is kind of a unique figure. And, you know, James, one thing that has happened is that it's almost as if for about an hour every night at Comedy Central, Voltaire has taken over television programming. And these two guys, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, really kind of try to hold the political establishment and the media establishment accountable in a way that almost nobody else does. And as great as he, as happy as he may be about getting to be the new David Letterman, we may actually lose something pretty significant when he goes.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. I mean, part of me thinks that, okay, he's looking at this as, you know, he wants a change. He wants to do something different. And this is an opportunity. And I congratulate him for that. But, you know, on the other hand, I think he's one of the most, well, he is probably the sharpest intelligence on TV doing this kind of thing. And the satisfaction that comes from actually living on that knife edge of, is he Stephen Colbert or is he the character, is endlessly entertaining. I mean, I watch it because you never know where exactly it's going. And it must be incredibly stimulating for him to be in that interaction with audience and like really every night. It seems obviously there's scripting, but it also has a kind of spontaneity about it, about reactions and about how he describes himself and where is he at that particular moment in time. I can't believe that won't be a loss for him, too. And I certainly think it'll be a loss for us. I mean, politically, to see somebody who's on that side of really like zeroing in on the essence of political discourse. I think that'll be a real loss.
But just as an act of performance, it didn't seem 7 years ago as though this would be possible. You know, that somebody would be able to wear this mask of the strutting, pompous, right-wing windbag and also somehow or other let the mask slip occasionally and be himself and speak as himself. But as you suggest, James, I mean, he does it every night. Every night, you know, he's wearing the mask and every once in a while you just see him looking through the mask with his real face at you, and the whole thing kind of holds together to a remarkable degree. So, Luis, what were your thoughts about this?
Well, first of all, I think that the combination of Jon Stewart and Colbert became, for a considerable amount of people in this country, the Walter Cronkite of the 21st century. Back in those days, those of you who are here in this country will know that everyone got the news and from the 6:30 broadcast in the evening news, and especially from Cronkite. And I think that for a significant number of people in this country, this became the evening news, now that it was just simply late evening news with a great deal of satire and parody and pretty punching comedy, which I think made it even more forceful than simply reading the news and straight out reporting. So to that extent, this is a great loss for the country, not only for people who might align themselves politically with Stewart and Colbert, but even for people who might not, because in a certain way, keeping them with a certain perspective. I think that for Colbert, what is remarkable is that at the same time that he was doing this character, he was also doing what I would say is himself. So there's a dialectic in the way he portrayed a character. Lastly, for now, my concern too is that the criticism in the show was not only in both shows. It's not only about the politicians; it's about the media establishment. A significant amount of the criticism in both shows is the media establishment, the mainstream media. So, to that extent, for him to go to mainstream media, I think will probably like tie up his hands to some extent. That's my fear.
You know, Susan Campbell, I'm sure you have many things to say about this. And not to make you all about religion either, although you're the only person here who went to seminary. So,
which makes me special.
Makes you very special. And so, you know, one of the interesting things about Colbert, one of the many ways he is different from anybody else doing a job like his, to the best of our knowledge anyway, is that he's a very serious, believing, devout Christian. Mm-hmm. I quote, I think this is from the LA Times, the Washington Post, "The man in reality and character is a devout and out Catholic, observer of Lent and teacher of Sunday school. Unlike other comedians of his persuasion, liberal though disguised as conservative, Colbert does not hide, ignore, downplay, or make light of his faith. On Ash Wednesday, he shows up with the obligatory smudge on his forehead. He has been known to recite bits of the Nicene Creed on the air. He has appointed a smart and articulate Jesuit, Father John Martin, as official chaplain of his show." And I assume he takes all these sensibilities over to the Letterman slot where you just don't see that.
No, you don't. And I don't know if you remember when his mother was so sick before she died. I think he let the mask down just for a moment. Mm-hmm. And I found it refreshing, and I don't want to be the contrarian, but I guess I will. I'm looking forward to what is next. I'm looking forward to seeing him with his real hair. Does he lacquer his hair in real life? There was a quote, I don't know if it was in the Times, where one of his New Jersey neighbors said, yeah, he's a regular guy, can hit him on the back of the head, which I guess is high praise. It's pretty cool. And I would like to see what Comedy Central puts in that time slot. They can't replace him, but God knows what they could come up with. They're fairly talented.
Well, I want to come back to the religion thing in a second, but obviously one of the things that will be interesting to see is, I mean, every decision on late night television, every time you think it's not going to be a white male this time, it's a white male.
Wouldn't it be nice that that'd be different?
So they've got Key and Peele available. They've got Amy Schumer available. They have even within their own kind of roster some other possibilities. I mean, within the Daily Show itself, there are people like Samantha Bee. And,
that's my choice. Samantha, I think we should start a Twitter revolution.
Yeah, I agree.
She's wonderful.
But, you know, I just want to go back to the religion thing for a second, because it really is, I mean, within the world that we live in and within the media world that we live in, it's so unusual. I mean, I think in some ways it's the really remarkable thing about Colbert. And I was talking earlier this week in a conversation with Thomas More about this play I'd seen, Freud's Last Session, in which, you know, it's Freud talking to C.S. Lewis. But C.S. Lewis seems undergunned somehow or other in this conversation. They sort of don't really give C.S. Lewis the same kind of intellectual firepower that they give Freud even in that play, even though I think the playwright means it to be something like a fair fight or an even match, but it's not.
You could see the bias.
You could see the bias, yeah. And to have somebody like this in a role that's, you know, and there couldn't be a more, you know, rigorous media nihilist than David Letterman. Not that he rejects religion necessarily, but he just has rejected everything.
Yeah.
So it'll be very interesting to see how Colbert threads this particular needle.
Well, he's done well on Comedy Central. You know his politics and you know his religion. I'm assuming he's going to be the same. I don't know what the real person's like. Frankly, I would get so tired of putting that fake persona on. I imagine he's a little happy not to have – I go back to the hair, not to lacquer the hair. But I would look to see mentions of faith in there, and that would be fine.
I also think that the context in which this is happening now is very interesting. It's a coincidence, I guess, is that the fact that Francis is now the Pope, mm-hmm. and the kind of politics or theology and lifestyle and so on that he has been putting on since he was elected a Pope creates an opening for Catholics who are more liberal. Even more radical, like in the old days, used to be back in the 60s and 70s in Latin America. I have a very, very close friend, a very dear friend, who is a Franciscan lay brother, an academic, a scientist in his field, to put it some way, and he's been always very open about his Catholicism, and he's a very, very liberal individual. So I'm one because I came from Latin America, where Catholicism in the 60s and 70s had a strain that was very radical. I don't see a contradiction between the two of them. And in fact, I admire people who are on that side of the political equation who are also openly religious.
Go ahead, James.
No, I was going to say one of the interesting aspects of this is reinvention to me, that you know, if you're in a position like – I can't see him, for instance, forever doing the Colbert Report, that as an artist and as an intelligent sort of, you know, inventive person, he's going to want to have some sort of way to grow. And I think there's an expectation in that show that he be that character. So I laud him for sort of taking a chance on this, and he's a smart enough guy that he may make it his own. But in the background of this, too, I think, is the fact that both shows, both the Comedy Central, which is Viacom, and CBS, they're both large corporations with large advertising budgets, and that plays into it as well. And one of the things that I've always found kind of particularly edgy about his appearance on the Colbert Report is that he almost trashes the sponsors. He almost trashes their products, but doesn't quite. And it's sort of like there's kind of there, okay, realizing who's actually paying the bills here. And so it's a difficult place to be. But I think CBS is maybe a little less likely to want that to happen. It's hard to tell, but I think he's smart enough that maybe he can twist that if he has a strong following, that the show develops a new identity, then he can probably get away with it. But I think that's a very interesting background.
It's a great question. And all you need to know to think more about this, or all you need to do, is go back and watch the movie American Splendor about Harvey Pekar. Harvey Pekar, right, for a long time, was kind of a favorite pet of Letterman's, except that Letterman just regarded him as this kind of endearing oddball with no social skills, which is the kind of person, particularly early in Letterman's career, that he was very good at having on and celebrating. And you had your Larry Bud Millmans and your brother Theodores and stuff like that. And he just thought Harvey Pekar was another one of those guys. At a certain point, Pekar really wanted to take Letterman on about NBC, about GE's ownership of NBC, about other stuff that GE was doing. And Letterman froze up on him and became, in that one famous exchange, I mean, just absolutely livid. And And you suddenly realize that Letterman was really only interested in being marginally transgressive.
Well, exactly. His paycheck. I mean, where are your loyalties?
And also, I mean, really who David Letterman is, he comes kind of out of the heartland. And he's not a guy interested in having conversations and batting things around with a real radical kind of person.
Can I drop a name really quick?
You may.
At the Wichita Eagle Beacon, I worked with his sister Gretchen. And every year they would go back to Indiana, I think, to have their church bulletin picture taken as a family. That's all I got.
The Lettermans would?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Which name are you, Sister Gretchen's name?
Gretchen Letterman, who I really liked.
But in the going back for a second to Colbert, we should remember that in his show there is a segment where he's interviewing people, and that segment perhaps gives us a clue as to how he will deal with people in the conversations in the talk show. Although, of course, not in a character necessarily. And I think that he demonstrated to be a great interviewer. Putting aside for a moment all the parody of the conservative, he was a very, in his show, he's always been a very witty interviewer who reacts to what people, in very quick thinking in his feet, what people are saying. So that gives me a great deal of hope that the show, in terms of the conversation with the guests, would be not exactly the dull show that some of these talk be.
Yeah, that may actually be one of the reasons why I think CBS wants it, is that one thing that is obvious is that the competition and the fragmentation of media generally means that having somebody as strong as that, who has a following and who's capable of thinking on his feet, that can be something that makes it distinctive and makes people watch. And that, I think, may be why they want to take a chance on him, that he's in some ways may be something of a loose cannon. But I'd be kind of interested to know the details of the contract. What can you do?
Yeah.
What can he get away with?
There is a number to follow up on what you're saying, James. A very good point is that was in the media reported that the Letterman show, since Fallon took over in NBC, has dropped significantly in the ratings, especially for the under 40 audience. I mean, by 17% in the last few weeks since Fallon took over on NBC. So in that way, I'm sure that CBS is welcoming the retirement, and who knows, that played a role in Letterman's decision to step down now.
Are we talking about this a lot because one of us wants Stephen Colbert's job?
No, I think that's I know they thought about James for a while, but
I don't think so.
He was busy.
Well, I think we're also talking about this a lot.
Time in the dark.
I mean, this is also a very, very tired format, this whole thing. If somebody comes out, they tell some jokes in a monologue for a while, then there's a little bit of conceptual or sketch comedy, and then the interview start, and there might be some music, and wow, I mean, they've got it going on all these different channels, but nobody really does anything different with it.
Right.
And you really do feel like somebody as restless as Colbert, who has already done a show that resembles really no other show. Mm-hmm. The likelihood that he'll do a show that would resemble anybody else's show seems lower. And the other thing I would say about this guy is, and it's interesting when you hear him interviewed, Terry Gross has done a series of fairly penetrating interviews with him where this intelligence comes out. But even I saw him go on Jimmy Kimmel's show and be interviewed, and the little lines and references that he tosses off in a very unscripted way. At one point, I think they were talking about something about babies or children and whether babies watch the shows or something. And Colbert says, yeah, well, we specialize in object permanence over on the Colbert Report. And that's kind of a Piaget kind of reference, you know? I don't think Jimmy Kimmel would have thrown – it was Jimmy Fallon. I'm sorry. Jimmy Fallon. I don't think either one of those guys would have thrown off a little Piaget joke about object permanence. This is a guy who reads and thinks. I watched him not live, but I've seen the tape of him in Sondheim's company where he acquits himself a full-blown Broadway performer with significant singing chops and stuff like that. This is a guy – I mean, one thing that's happened – I mean, Fallon is a little bit a part of this trend too. They suddenly have some of these late-night show hosts who can actually do something.
Besides talk. Mm-hmm. Okay, so who's going to break the barrier of the white dudes behind a desk?
Well, Samantha Bee's won nomination.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd vote for Samantha Bee.
Chris Rock.
I would say that.
I would turn him loose.
I would say that even though, cable is not the same as broadcast, and you can get away with a lot of things on cable. She might not be hired because she's beyond edgy for a lot of people. My vote would be for Sarah Silverman.
Sarah Silverman?
Yep.
I mean, one of the things you have to think about is And Letterman has talked about this at times too, that he I'm trying to remember how he put it. Bill Curry was talking to me about this the other day. But in interviews, he said that sometimes he gradually realized that the role of host was more important than the joke. And that sometimes he'd have to sacrifice the joke, whatever it was, for the role of host. Mm-hmm. Because the reality of these shows are, if you watch them, it is like a date. You know, it's a regular date you have for four nights a week with another human being. And yeah, you might watch Stewart and Colbert because their satire and their ability to kind of hold powerful people accountable is really impressive, and it fascinates you, and there's just a lot of interesting logic even that goes into their shows that you don't hear anywhere else. But really, with these kind of late night things, it's you got to like the person, you've got to be comfortable enough with the person. Now, I think Sarah Silverman is really funny, but as the case with Chris Rock, 80% of their acts would have to go. I mean, you know, 80% of what we like about them,
their jokes,
that you simply cannot say on late night television. And I'm not sure people want to be with Sarah Silverman every night, you know?
What's the rule here?
I guess I am in a minority.
What's the rule here? Do you sacrifice jokes so that other people can talk?
Well, the rule here is, if you think about the shift from the show that I did for 16 years on WTIC, which was much more about me and about me being funny in a certain way. And when I got here, I just realized there was no place for that. That, you know, public radio is about a different kind of content. So, yeah, you do.
Conversation more so.
Right. And you get out of other people's way.
So can I sit there after the break?
Yeah, you want to?
Okay.
All right. No, it's, you know, it's nothing but fretting.
You know, I'm lying. I don't want it.
Nothing but cold sweat. All right. Well, we're going to take a break right now because we've got two other topics we want to cover. I'm sorry if you didn't get on the air. A couple people sort of called in, and then I didn't get to them fast enough, and they hung up, and I feel bad about that.
Stephen always fights for truth and justice and the American way. And he'll say the things uncouth that was Jon Stewart's too scared to say. And forget about Geraldo, who once got hit by a chair. God bless Stephen Colbert.
All right, we're back with The Nose. Susan Campbell, James Hanley, and Luis Figueroa are here in studio with us. Joan Carroll tweeted during the previous segment, don't forget the White House Correspondents' Dinner, hashtag good lord. Yeah, we did sort of forget to talk about that, but it is an amazing example of Colbert being able to completely flummox the audience in front of him while communicating exquisitely with the people who are going to see it on the television feed or on YouTube afterwards. So we are going to move on here. I do wonder when and if I am going to do my last ever John Roland show.
When you die.
Yeah, right, exactly. Or write my last John Roland column. It just doesn't ever seem to come. So last night, as I was getting ready to go to the gym, I was conferring on the phone with somebody who said, well, I thought the indictment was going to be today. And I said, well, it doesn't really look like that. I went to the gym. I went from the gym to the grocery store. In the grocery store, I ran into Steve Metcalf, who said, well, you know that your friend John Roland got indicted. And I thought, wow, you can't take an hour off here. It's just you got to watch at all times. So John Roland, in fact, has been indicted 7 different counts. They do apply, in fact, to his involvement. I'm sort of like a Rolandologist. I should just sit here and be a resource for the other three of you. I mean, I know way too much about this story. I know way too much about all John Roland stories. I really should be just the reference librarian this conversation.
Forgive me for interrupting. May I ask you a question then?
Yeah.
Given my past life of crime,
right,
you learn one of two things when you are arrested for being naughty. One, you learn that you shouldn't do that and don't do it again. Or two, you learn to do it better. But he managed to not learn either of those things and repeated his sins of the past.
That wasn't a question, but it was a great observation.
I'm getting to the question. I like building up to my 5-minute-long question. Why? Why
okay.
do you do it?
Yeah, I think I do have sort of an answer. First of all, people may want to chime in about this, or they may be exhausted with the topic. Either way, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. I'm pretty sure I've written my last Joe Lieberman column. Probably had my last Joe Lieberman show. Someday I will have my last John Roland experience, but not yet. You know, in 2002, the then existent Northeast Magazine of the Hartford Courant hired me to write a piece that was called Why We Love the Gov. And that's what they wanted to call it. And they wanted somebody who was a diehard critic of John Rowland to write a piece to try to figure out why people like him so much, why he wins elections, et cetera. And so I did. It was an interesting experience. But they said I had to start from the premise that people do like him and there must be a reason. And it was an interesting thought experiment, as they say. But one of the people I talked to, it was Paul Tiger, who's a personality expert. He studies Myers-Briggs type personality classifications. And he had been quite an observer of Rowland. And he said, you know, what he is, he said there's two kinds of cops. He said there's the kind of cop who really is in it to protect and serve, you know, and law and order and protection and service and the notion of kind of a civic good. And there's another kind of cop who runs on adrenaline and is in it for the adrenaline. And he said if Rowland were a cop, he'd be that second kind of cop, and that he is what in the world of personality classification is called an experiencer. And Paul Tiger said, in that kind of person, they deal with what's in front of them at any given moment.
Like a 2-year-old.
Well, I'm not here to layer on my own judgments. I'm just telling you. But yeah, they deal what's in front of them at the moment. This problem, this meal, this parking space, this whatever it is, it's in front of them. They are dealing with it. They are not thinking a week out, 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out. They're not thinking long-term consequences and ramifications. And he felt that John Rowland was the epitome of that. And was not asking himself some of these long-term questions.
Does the experiencer tend to go into politics, something really visible?
I don't know whether that's you'd have to ask Paul about that. Although one thing that Paul was very helpful to me in understanding Rowland, because another thing he said about John Rowland is that sort of Myers-Briggs and systems like this, they divide people into two axes in four different ways. But one of the axes is the sensor versus the intuitive. So the intuitive looks at sort of underlying meaning, asks multiple questions about things, explores any given thing for its deeper ramifications, is capable of holding two or three different mildly contradictory ideas in their own heads at any given time. Whereas the sensor, and for James's benefit, I will bring in a cinematic reference. In The Deer Hunter, the moment when Robert De Niro holds up a cartridge and he's yelling at John Cassale and he says, "You see this, Stan? This is this. It's not some other thing. It's this." That's how censors think. They think about, and 65% of America, or 65% of the world, are censors. They don't explore deep meanings. They see what's there and they talk about it. And one of the reasons Rowland was an effective politician was he could speak to people in a way that they absolutely understood. They were never uncertain about what he was saying.
Well, at the same time, you know, I think he had a contempt for the voters because one of the stories that's most interesting that forever sort of zeroed in my impression of kind of a low rent Richard Nixon is that over the hot tub affair, he went on TV and said, it was just some kitchen cabinets were put in there by, you know, they were Home Depot cabinets. And in fact, they were craftsman cabinets by a skilled carpenter whose wife then went on TV and exploded and said what a contemptuous thing to say about something that was actually a theft from the public, which was a lovely sort of like nexus of exactly who Rowland is. And I've never forgotten that.
So at least acknowledged they were really nice cabinets.
Yeah.
Other thing that happened at that time, and it has repeated itself, he did go before the press at that time and say that those home improvements were paid for by a home equity loan. And I remember actually listening to this with the person with whom I live, and she said to me, without even really looking up, she said, "He doesn't have a home equity line." And I said, "Well," I said, "that's ridiculous because, I mean, that's such a checkable thing. I mean, John Lender can go and verify this immediately because it attaches to the deed and, you know." So he wouldn't lie about it. She said, "He doesn't have a home equity loan."
And turns out she was right.
He did not have a home equity loan. So, which is a remarkable thing to do, to go in front of a bunch of people like investigative reporters like John Lender and say you have something, which they can very easily figure out that you don't.
I want to go back to the comment that you made from this person you talked to about the cop that is runs on the adrenaline, and the adrenaline is what has that cop on the job. That kind of cop would volunteer for do all kinds of more risky things, being in special kind of teams or forces, SWATs and so on. I'm sure trying to visualize that individual. And what what I've read about Roland in this particular case, what strikes me is that he seems to definitely run on some kind of adrenaline in terms of being involved in politics, because he was barred from being in politics, I suppose, right? That's what the press and you have been saying in recent weeks. And yet he had to feel that he was doing something.
He wanted to be caught.
He wanted to be involved in politics, and the only way he saw doing it was by doing these consultancies. But this was, you know, something that would become very controversial, and who knows if he could legally do it or not. And what is behind it, too, is he sense that he knows the state of Connecticut, and he knows the politics, and he knows the people here better than no other political consultant. And he will be able to manipulate things so that these candidates that he was trying to help will get elected. Because in the emails that are quoted, he says, "You, your main campaign or campaign chief will tell you that I'm not good, and but I know the voters in Connecticut and so on and so forth." So he felt that he could manipulate us in a particular way, like he did when he was in front of the camera, as opposed to now, in this case, behind a computer writing emails.
Yeah, you've got a theory, James, right?
Well, that's why I made the Richard Nixon reference, because I think that Richard Nixon really deeply wanted to be caught, like really, really caught. And all of his, like underneath of all of his plotting and his paranoia about being hated and about people who are after him, I think that Roland has the same sort of thing that he has this sort of dual thing of having this perceived connection with the voters, yet he behaves contemptuously towards them. And therefore, to me, that reads as somebody, okay, he knows that he knows where he is and who he is. And there's this deep desire to get caught, because if you look at the things that he did, I mean, could it be just that he's ignorant about email and electronic stuff? No. People do stuff like that, I think, because they are ultimately there's a discordance there. There's a dissonance in the way they're behaving and who they really are. And to me, it's like, you know, I wonder if inwardly he feels a kind of relief when he gets caught. I don't know.
It would explain. I mean, I want to go to calls from Ned and from Jim, but it does explain something that does happen pretty frequently. But I was astonished this time around. I mean, I think most people understand that sending an email is a lot less like sending a letter and a lot more like typing something that's going to go up on one of those screens they have on the highway telling you that there's going to be night construction.
And learn to spell in your emails and learn punctuation, please.
I think most people just understand how incredibly easily obtainable these emails are, either through FOI laws or subpoenas or whatever. And so many people – I mean, when I read last night, once again, every time I think I've read the last thing – but going through the federal allegations as the indictment was posted last night, the idea that he had actually, in his first attempt to create a fictitious contract as a political consultant, the first time with Mark Greenberg, who turned him down, he actually wrote the contract himself and then emailed it to somebody else just to show it to them. And I'm thinking,
do you not know?
But maybe James is right. Maybe this is all part of some very, very deeply buried wish for self-destruction. Let me just grab a call or two here. We can keep this conversation going. This is Ned in West Hartford. Hi, Ned.
Hey, Colin. All your ruminations and summations sort of remind me about the clean energy investigation. You have gas and you have torches. It was just stupid, just like John Roland. He's just plain stupid. Why would he do it again?
Yeah, because
the thrill—the thrill of it, the thrill of being caught.
That's Luis is also saying that too. The adrenaline is probably a big part of it. And I mean, it is true that, you know, I keep going back to everything's a movie analogy today. But Hal Holbrook standing there in the garage in All the President's Men, and at one point he says to Robert Redford, "This isn't the brightest bunch of guys in the world."
Right.
So maybe a little bit of that there. Let me grab one more call from Jim in Bloomfield. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. I don't really have a movie analogy to offer, but it occurs to me that perhaps we really are overthinking this a little bit. We've got a guy who just seems to be incapable of being honest. He's proven time and again to be deceitful. James used the phrase, a theft from the public, and I can think of all kinds of things that he has taken from us, including the principle of justice with his now apparently quite too early release from prison. You know, this is a guy who's just untrustworthy, and in that regard, he's probably a lot more common than we want to think. I'm pretty disgusted by all of this. I can't wait to see him get another day in court where I hope justice really will be served.
All right. Well, that begins at 2:30 today. But, okay, in her new capacity as a chaplain of the Colin McEnroe Show.
Does that pay?
No.
Oh, crap. Figures.
You know, I've been really sort of struggling with the question. I mean, watching this downfall, and it is a downfall.
It is.
And it's a second downfall, and it's a downfall that will ripple out. It will obviously affect his wife, who may or may not be culpable in a lot of this stuff. It'll affect his kids, who I think really do look up to him. It'll affect all kinds of people. And it is the idea of anybody going back to prison a second time is, you know, I mean, one's sympathies are run the risk of being aroused anyway. And so I've been really struggling with this question of whether I feel sorry for this man or not, whether – I mean, there's two concepts, I guess, sympathy and mercy. And I know as much about his wrongdoings as probably just about anybody who's not employed as a federal prosecutor or an FBI investigator. I mean, I really do know a lot about a lot of the things that he has done wrong and gotten away with for the most part going back decades. And yet, I don't know. I'm torn about this. You know?
Do you feel like you should be able to – forgive him or
– yeah, because he's not Idi Amin. I mean, he's a
he
kind
didn't
of –
kill anyone.
He's a dirty politician, you know, and – but, I mean, he's not Idi Amin. He hasn't done really horrible things. So would it be karmically, spiritually good for me if I just – if I were able to find some kind of sympathy and mercy?
Probably, yes. But when you mentioned Richard Nixon, I will go to my grave cheerfully disliking that man. And I do wonder sometimes because someone says Nixon and I'm on point because yeah. Let me tell you about that guy. I didn't know the guy. Mm. Probably for both of our sakes, we should find some for – whether it's forgiveness or an understanding that he's messed up. If you are so – anxious to feel the adrenaline or get caught, and the thrill of getting caught is worth risking so much for your family, if not yourself, then probably somewhere in there we could find – I'm not suggesting I'm going to, but it might be a good thing.
Well, isn't that a personal sense of somebody who's transgressed that you can forgive, that as an individual, maybe somebody you know, and you find it in your heart to forgive even a heinous thing that they've done toward you personally? But I think there's another level on this, which is as a public official, somebody who is like who's taken on being a public official as their career, there's a whole other level that I don't think that is a matter of forgiveness. That's a matter of being caught with the goods.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very simple to me. I don't think that is a matter of forgiveness. I think in a personal sense, you can say, well, I'm sorry for the guy. And
maybe
it's a
that.
Shame.
Yeah, I inserted forgiveness into the conversation. But there was a lot of talk the first time around of public trust.
Yes.
The public trust.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that is so, so relevant right now in terms of how we live, public trust. And when you trash that public trust, to me, that's a real high crime and misdemeanor. I mean, it's very serious.
Hmm. Betsy Kaplan, who's the only grown-up affiliated with the show, is sort of saying that I should – find something, whether it's sympathy, empathy, whatever we're going to call it, that one should find something.
Maybe you should walk away from him for a while. Take a break.
I need to quit him. Well, before we end this conversation about this, we do want to save a little bit of time for the possible wife of Jesus. Luis, did you want to say something? I posted today on the Hartford Current website a 1990 official congressional photograph of John Rowland when he was a congressman from the 5th District. And in it, he has... straight out of American Hustle.
Say it. Yep.
He has what is sometimes referred to as a porn star mustache. Or, you know, but also if you've seen American Hustle, there's a lot of that kind of facial hair too. So is there something?
First of all, I would say that I know when you post certain things on Facebook about Roland, there are some people who comment quite critical of what you're saying. I think that an earlier a column that you wrote very recently about him where you were talking about the rat in Charlotte's Web, that was one of the better columns that I read. And then I run into this one with that picture and the thing about signing the emails, love the Gov.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at that picture, and that picture to me, can be read in many ways. One of them is this is 1990. Mm-hmm. This is when he was a congressman. He was elected congressman when he was 27. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So he knew, it seems to me that from that picture, he knew from the beginning, I'm doing things that you don't know, and I'm getting away with it, kind of grin. Under the hair and his mustache over his upper lip, that seems to be like trying to hide who really this guy is. Because the grin there in that picture is, I am getting away with things, and I will get away with things for the rest of my life in the state of Connecticut.
So in the words of Rod Stewart, every picture tells a story, don't it? All right. Do we even have time to talk about the wife? We have to talk. See, we have the author of Dating Jesus here. We have to say something about this.
About Jesus.
So, in fact, this question. All right. There's this controversial scrap of papyrus that may or may not have been part of the non-canonical Gospel of Thomas, that in which it appears that Jesus is quoted as saying something like, "My wife, she is able to be my disciple." There's been all kind of Da Vinci Code type speculation about this, and some questions about whether it was even legit, whether it even would survive the other kind of dating, the carbon dating. But it appears to be old enough anyway. Now, I mean, there's so many things to say about this, and we have so little time. But and one of the things that we have to say is that the Gospels that became canonical, I mean, it was either an arbitrary or divinely influenced process by which certain books about Jesus written at more or less the same time became part of the Gospels, became part of the canon. So it may not even mean anything other than at a certain time maybe there were a few hundred people who thought he had a wife.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think what they found this most – and this really surfaced the fall of 2012, I think. And the woman who has been championing this keeps saying this is not an indication specifically that Jesus had a wife. But look at just the suggestion that he might have, and people pee all over the floor. It's incredible. What I would invite them to do.
This is the chaplain of her.
This is Reverend Campbell speaking about urine. I'm done with it. I would invite people who really worry about this kind of thing to do a little research and see how the books that you read in your Christian Bible were assembled, and then that might make you not worry so much about this scrap of paper. I would suggest that there were women who were disciples. I'm totally okay if he was married, and you've got generations of priests going, I knew it. So get over yourselves, people who are worried.
But the reason people care a little bit is so much of the church's teaching
is based on women sitting in the back pew. And wouldn't it be fabulous if we all get to heaven and women aren't sitting in the back pew? That's my vote.
Right. But I think that I want to follow on this issue, the historicity of this, because I think that, to me, the issue of the wife and that she could be a disciple and so on is fundamental in this controversy. But even as big as that is to remind people that the Gospels are not the Gospels in the metaphorical sense of the word gospel. There were other Gospels that have been written about. I saw years ago a great documentary on public television that dealt with this. And if you look at Professor King's, the scholar behind the text, her page at Harvard describing her, she's the author of several books. This is not some wacko writing about this thing. She has also written a book about the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. So people have to keep in mind that these things were written well after the life of the historical Jesus. They were not at that point.
James, if you can see something really quick.
Just the one thing I would say is that all the obsession with sort of dating this piece of paper and sort of carbon dating and so on, isn't it possible that it really, really is really, really old and will be verified, but that at the time the person who did it had an agenda? And maybe they did frauds then too. So right. What do you know?
Yeah, that's all you really do know is that somebody said that way back then. All right, we in order to have time for endorsements, we gotta go.
I have been given treasures in heaven. I'll not repine. I shall not repine. Onward I'm going, happy in knowing Jesus is mine.
If it turns out we all have to change our passwords, I feel bad for Roadrunner. Everything is beep, beep. Gmail, Facebook, PIN code. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Skylar Magnoli. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Talarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tom Snyder. For show pages, articles, and a video of the Faith Middleton Show staff throwing their shoes at Hillary Clinton, visit WNPR.org. On Monday, we're back with the news of the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
All right, yes, one of our favorite writers, Jen Dahl, will be joining me for a conversation on The Scramble. So it's time for endorsements. And so here we go. Luis Figueroa, what have you got?
Well, I have an endorsement here. The topic of binge-watching has been a very recurrent topic in the news and in your show in general. And so the other day, I had a conversation with a friend and, about one particular sketch or skit in the show years ago that was like a game show. Geek, dweeb, or spaz. So I didn't see that. Let me see where I can find that. Through that rabbit hole, I found out that all 39 seasons of SNL are available in Hulu. Mm. And so I said, well, I was super curious because I looked at the first episode hosted by George Carlin. And I really want to encourage people who have Hulu or could get Hulu to watch it. It's a great experience going back. And so now my binge watching will take, I don't know, a considerable amount of time watching all 39 years of SNL.
The rest of your life.
That's part of my life.
Now I'll play. James Hanley, what have you got?
Two very heavy duty books, but really worth reading about capitalism. One is Thomas Piketty, who's a French economist, a Harvard economist, called Capitalism in the 21st Century, which is absolutely, I mean, it's intense, but very rewarding about reading about where capitalism is now. And another one, which is a little more accessible, Michael Lewis, Flash Boys, about the whole nature of high-frequency trading and the reason why investing is very different for ordinary people as opposed to people who have high-frequency trading connections.
All right, Susan Gamble.
I would like to endorse Jesus' wife and his brothers and sisters. They're a lovely family. And also endorse Tempest Toss, The Spirit of Isabella Beecher Hooker. My book launch party is at 7 o'clock on Wednesday at Harriet Beecher Stowe. Free food, live music, please come.
All right, so go there. That's Wednesday, what time?
7.
It's always good to repeat it. All right, so since James is being too altruistic, he's passing around the schedule for Trinity Cine Studio. There are many exciting things, including The Wind Rises, which I think you do want to see on a big screen, right?
Definitely. It's amazing.
And so check out the Trinity Cine Studio schedule in general, because he's got a whole bunch of really exciting things coming up, many of which I will be at. All right. I may have already endorsed this once before. I'm not 100% sure. But the remodeled Yale Art Gallery, which you may go into for free. There is no admission charge. And some of the things that they have done there are absolutely startling. And I've now been there. My son and I make a regular habit now of going there about, you know, well, almost every week. And so ranging from this kind of recreation of a buried town from about 240 AD, and kind of an outpost post of the Roman Empire called Dura Europa, which is sort of, I think, up in kind of near where Syria and Iran are now. It's just a remarkable thing, and you see all these different cultures coming together. It's the best snapshot of the Roman Empire I've ever seen anywhere. I mean, you really kind of get a sense of early Christians and Jews and Hellenic worshipers and people who worship, you know, a bull cult. And it's unbelievable. So that's great. And then I've just been kind of wandering around the museum on subsequent visits. Last Saturday, I was up in the room that has three really, truly remarkable hoppers. But you pick whatever you want. They now have the space to exhibit what's a pretty remarkable collection, and it's just a very rewarding day to spend your Saturday. So go to New Haven. You can go to the Farmers Market. It's indoors on Water Street. The regular old Worcester Square Farmers Market is indoors for the winter, and they really do have stuff. And then you go back downtown. You get a latte from Willoughby's. You walk around a little bit till you finish that. And then you go to the Yale Art Gallery, and you're having yourself a pretty good day in the Elm City. So I want to thank those wonderful panel today, Susan Campbell, James Hanley, Luis Figueroa. We'll be back on Monday with The Scramble. I guess that's all.
Yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah. Radio, baby. You and me talking, laughing down. I'm acting more.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Stephen Colbert, congratulations, man. It turns out that making fun of Bill O'Reilly leads to more success than actually being Bill O'Reilly.